Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 21st of April, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, news editor at theconstructionindex.co.uk. How are you doing there, Phil?
I'm doing very well, David. How are you doing?
Well, I'm fine. It's still freezing cold here, though. Hasn't rained for weeks. Gardening's on hold. Might as well just do a podcast, I suppose.
Well, it's our favourite thing to do, isn't it?
On a Wednesday, yes, why not? So, Phil, what's caught your eye this week? Anything interesting?
Quite a few things, actually. But I'm going to start off with something which got the national newspapers as interested as we did, which is the return of a man called Jeff Fairbairn, who I'm sure many listeners won't need reminding, is famous for his variously reported £75 million bonus when he was chief executive of Persimmon.
I remember.
And it was an odd story about his end at Persimmon, and maybe we'll go back to that in a moment. But the reason why he's in the news now is a year ago he bought a half share of a small Weatherby developer builder called Barclay de Vere, which sounds, mm-hmm. I mean, could it sound any posher? Barclay de Vere?
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't sound like a builder, does it?
And with that as his vehicle, with some backing from private equity or venture capitalists, he has bought a company called Avant Homes, who are somewhat bigger. Mm-hmm. Avant Homes were, once upon a time, Gladedale. They, like many house builders, fell victim to the 2008-2009 credit crunch, you know, Lehman Brothers and all of that. And they were taken over by banks. I don't know who the banks were. That was it. Lloyds and HBOS, one of those, I'm not sure. But then they were taken into bought out by a private equity firm, Alchemy, in 2014. And Alchemy had put Avant Homes on the block a few months ago. And we don't know the purchase price, but reports suggested it was somewhere around 500 million-ish, maybe. And Jeff Fairbairn's new vehicle, Barclay de Vere, has bought Avant Homes. And so puts it in top 20, I believe-ish, UK house building companies.
Well, it was already in the top 20. When I looked in December in our sector focus in the magazine, it was, number 17, something like
that. Right, okay. So
it's been in the top 20 for a while, I think.
And it's a 500 million turnover house builder. And it's just interesting to see Jeff Fairbairn.
Well, I've got this sort of mental image of a sort of shifty-looking bloke standing in front of a pile of bricks. And then he sort of sloped off during a BBC interview when the questions started getting interesting.
That's right. The Look North journalist at the end of the interview said, how about this huge bonus of yours then? And with the cameras rolling, exactly that. He was sort of like, why do you have to bring that up? It's a pity. I'm going to have to go now. And sort of wandered off.
Yeah.
when in fact, I mean, here's a man who went straight from school onto building sites, worked his way up to the company, joined Persimmon at a young age, became chief executive in 2013, and as chief executive, he more than doubled the value of the company, and it was clearly hugely successful. It wasn't his idea that there should be this long-term incentive plan that was set up in 2012 before he became chief executive.
I'm sure he said, no, that's not a good idea.
No, but I don't think anyone really expected. the problem was that it was just a too generous plan. They should have capped it or something.
No.
But it's easy in hindsight to see that. And it was supposed to, he was entitled to 110 million. And there's such an outcry. I said, "All right, I'm going to set up a charity, and I'll only take 75 million. I'll get by on that." And what made it worse is that the Guardian newspaper and others kind of like, "Well, okay, let's keep an eye on this charity that he sets up." And they found, I think even as recently as a few months ago, there had been nothing registered in his name or associated with his name at all with the Charities Commission. Someone else reported that a spokesman for Mr. Fairbairn said, well, you know, you can set up a charity without registering with the Charities Commission. There are other ways of doing charities. But it seems to me that if you're doing it not through the Charities Commission, you probably can't get the... I mean, I assume gift aid comes into play here, which is quite a generous way of getting tax back on charitable donations. Yeah. So, yeah, Jeff Fairbairn is seen by the sort of the Guardian universe as being the bogeyman of the avaricious, capitalist, greedy fat cat, right up there with who's the Cedric Brown, wasn't it? The British gas man.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Got all that huge.
Or Fred Goodwin. I always get
him
confused
as well.
With Fred Goodwin.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Another one.
So what exactly is it about Jeff Fairbairn that makes you feel sorry for him, Phil? I'm struggling here.
Well, he's a man who worked himself up from his bootstraps, self-made, climbed the company, got to the top, and the company said, if you do achieve X, Y, Z, we'll give you shed loads of money. So he did X, Y, Z. He didn't steal any money from anyone.
The
problem was that Persimmon, and like so many house builders, grew so fat at this time, on the back of right to buy and government support, taxpayer-funded support.
Yeah.
I'm sure they also paid a lot of tax back to the Treasury in this time as well. But it's you said you didn't like the phrase the other week. You don't like the phrase about the optics. The optics not looking good. Clearly, the optics don't look good around this man. But he must be a very...
I still find it hard to feel sorry for somebody who has been criticised for taking a £75 million bonus. I mean, you can afford to insulate yourself against any criticism on that score. You don't want to be put into prison. He's not going to be... He might be barred from his local pub, I suppose. I don't know. But, I don't know. Yeah, all right then. I suppose that probably he had to soak up a bit of criticism, which perhaps should have been directed elsewhere. But, I mean, at that price, you know, bring it on. I'd do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, would you rather have 75 million in the world hate you or be lying in the gutter looking at the stars and everyone thinks you're great?
Yeah. Well, I know which one I'd choose.
Yeah, I'm on his
anyway.
Side.
So why do you think he's got back into house building again? Do you think it's just... It's one of those things where you've done it all your life, you just can't let it go.
It's clearly good.
But he's sitting at home in his mansion doing Sudoku and thinks, well, you know, I need something a little bit more stimulating to keep me busy. Because let's face it, he doesn't need the money.
No, but he's too young to stop doing anything. He's younger than you and I. He's, what is it, I don't know, 55 or something. Yeah, I think he's got plenty to offer and he wants to keep going.
Why well, as you say, he's obviously good at what he does. So I should imagine that Avant will welcome him with open arms. Avant isn't a struggling business as far as I can tell. It made a profit. I mean, its turnover went up in 2019 by a sort of a fairly reasonable margin. Its profits went down slightly, but it seems fairly stable despite its problems of a few years ago. So, you know, he's got something good to work with there.
Hey, listen, house builders don't lose money at the moment.
No, that's true.
Privately owned Hill Group posted their results yesterday. We're speaking on Wednesday, so Tuesday this week, Hill Group posted their results.
Yeah.
And they're, even in calendar year 2020, with all that COVID could throw at them, they grew their pre-tax profit by 4% to £44 million.
Really?
Sales were up 12%, pre-tax profit up 4%. Even with everything COVID and house building, as we know, was hit harder by site closures than other sectors of the construction industry.
Well, I'm sure there was a house builder that made a loss last year. I'm just trying to check. Well, I'm talking about the top 20 here. So,
but you haven't had many 2020 results in your list, I don't think. We haven't had many 2020.
No, sorry, I mean the top 20. What am I talking about? The top 20. Who made a loss?
But are you looking at calendar 2020?
Galliard Group. Galliard Group made a loss, according to my figures here. Telford Homes and Kier Living.
Oh, well, Kier Living...
I might have to check those figures, but anyway.
Well, Kia Living are in the news, of course, because they are, well, Kia Group have agreed the sale of Kia Living
yes.
to a well-known, prominent chap called Guy Hands, someone even richer than Jeff Fairburn, who owns a private equity firm called Terra Firma. Didn't they buy, was it EMI, a Terra Firma buyout, one of their famous ones? But they bought loads
of stuff
over the years, Terra Firma. And they've agreed to buy Kia Living for 110 million, I think the figure is, which is going to see Kia's debt reduced by a good slug.
Yeah, I should imagine so.
But they're still going to have to have a rights issue at Kia for another, I think, about 200 million. They're hoping to get in addition to that. But
so why does Kia want to sell it? Why are they selling it?
Well, it's all part of this restructuring.
Apart from the fact they made a loss.
Well, Kia have lost something close to £500 million in the past couple of years. And they're going through a major restructuring. And Andrew Davis came in a couple of years ago to sort it all out. And he's the guy who was supposed to go in to rescue Carillion, I think, wasn't he? And then they disappeared. He'd previously been chief executive of Waits. And Carillion said, come and save us. And he said, OK, I'll be with you in January. But before he managed to get his foot through the door, they'd already gone belly up. So he didn't manage to save them.
Yeah.
So Kia said, well, we could do with your help. Can you come sort us out instead? And it looks like he's done a pretty good job there.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a rights issue more to get the debt down. Their debt currently £353 million end of December. But what's interesting about these companies that run into trouble so often, like Kia did and Balfour Beatty a few years before, and they had their big turnaround. I think Carillion, to a certain extent, possibly the same story, but less so. It's all to do with acquisitions.
Mm.
And it's amazing how often people think acquisitions is a great way to grow. But as often as not, it's a bit of a last throw of the dice. If you're a publicly quoted company, you have to demonstrate growth to appease shareholders, to maintain shareholder dividends, to feed the beast. Every year, you're expected to make a bigger profit with less money in your budget. And you think, it's not like you run a corner shop where you're allowed to take out, you know, 50 grand a year profit for you and your family to live comfortably on and have the same money coming in real terms and live and just carry on doing that. Now, if you're in the capitalist corporate environment, you've got to have a cut your budgets every year and increase your profits and otherwise you're not doing it right, which I think is a flaw in the capitalist model.
Yeah.
But often the way that growth is achieved or the way it's seen as the only way to be achieved is to take someone else over.
Which is always risky, of course.
Well, yeah. Acquisitions, okay, I hate to use the jargon of synergy, but it's an important word here. They talk about, you know, that two organisations coming together should be stronger, ideally, than each individual company was on its own. So the whole is greater than the sum of the components.
Yeah.
That's rarely the case.
Well, a lot of businesses have come a cropper by overreaching themselves with acquisitions, haven't they? I mean, the history of Western capitalism must be littered with examples of that.
This brings us sort of neatly onto our next topic I'd like to talk to, which is, I think, possibly the most, and I have no data to back this up, but I'm going to hazard a guess that the most acquisitive company in the country at the moment is an environmental engineering group called RSK, who appear to be a very successful outfit. They appeared in the Sunday Times, I don't know, fast track, fastest growing private companies or something quite recently. They get a lot of big press. And this is a company in the past 5 years have made 50 acquisitions in the past 5 years. Now, we talked about a minute ago about how many people come a cropper. RSK are showing no sign of coming a cropper, but neither are they showing any sign of making any money. Ran a story last week about their latest acquisitions, and these aren't mostly, I was going to say that they aren't big, prominent acquisitions, although they did just buy part of Black & Veatch, which was the old Binney business, water and water consulting engineers. And they've revived the name Binney, which is, I don't know how big a business is, but it's a huge historic brand in the water industry. And there are other interesting brands and divisions within RSK.
Well, we had one of their directors on the podcast, didn't we, last year? Stephanie Ray from RSK Wilding. Do you remember she came on and
talked
to us about rewilding? Yeah, which was very interesting.
Well, this shows the range of stuff that they do. I mean, they've got fingers in all sorts of pies. Anyway, I ran this post on Construction Index saying that they've clocked up their 50th acquisition, but their losses continue to widen. And their PR representative, an agency that they employ to promote them, woman from this organisation rang me up and said, no problem with the article, content of the article. It's all factually accurate, all quite correct. But would like Construction Index to get to know RSK better, because feel that we might not know them as well as we should. And would we like to talk to Alan Ryder, the owner and founder of RSK? Alan Ryder set up RSK in 1989. I said, yeah, fantastic. We had Steph on the podcast last year. Let's get him on the podcast. That'd be great. He says, no, he's very shy. He doesn't actually talk to journalists. But if you send him some questions, he'll give you some very long answers. And I said, well, I sent him a question last week saying, when do you expect to make a profit? And the answer I got back was that essentially, I believe we have never been better placed, and I'm looking forward to taking the business forward, which didn't really answer my question. So the idea of sending in written questions, and I mean, that's not an interview, and anyone calls that an interview.
No.
You know, an interview is where two people talk, not where they write letters to each other.
So that didn't happen then?
I said, well, I might try sending some questions again. I said, well, if you take the mention of losses out of your headline, then he'll answer your questions. But you need to change the headline for him to answer any of your questions. I said, that's fine, thanks. I can wait. I can wait till the next financial report. But you know, rest assured, I said, when RSK does report a profit, I will make it our lead story and get very prominently with how it's all worked out. Right. But in the year to April 2020, their turnover was up 34%. Largely, I suspect entirely, on the back of acquisitions. And they made a pre-tax loss of something short of £16 million. And they've got this, so they're turning over £280 million and their debt of £240 million. That's pretty high gearing, especially for a company which is essentially a consultancy company. I mean, a lot of companies have got heavy debts, and it can be quite a healthy way to sweat your assets and whatever. But as I would understand, a consultancy company, most of its assets are its people. I mean, every company says that our people are our best assets or whatever, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, exactly.
But actually, for a manufacturing
for
company,
a consultancy, it's true.
Yes, but for some companies heavily indebted, they'll have lots of plant and machinery, they'll have factories, they'll have inventory and stock and all sorts of things. I can't imagine. RSK may own lots of property, I don't know, lots of its offices. But I can't imagine it's got lots in the way of factories and plant and stock. But it is backed by venture capital, which is a common theme in so many cases, where venture capitalists get in and say, here, have our money.
Yeah.
You take the risk and we'll take the interest out of you every year and the consultancy fees out of you every year.
Well.
But RSK, they are on their way to, they're planning on doubling. Alan Ryder has this goal of doubling the company from 500 million to a billion turnover within, I can't remember, 3 to 5 years, but medium term. So they have emerged relatively from nowhere quickly to become a major, major player in the world of civil engineering and environmental engineering.
Yeah, it's astonishing. I mean, I'd never heard of Alan Ryder before, ever, until you mentioned him.
I'm told by the PR woman that is paid to promote him that he is a lovely chap, and he really cares about the business and about the people in it. And any suggestion that this is some venture capitalist, rapacious buying spree slash and burn, couldn't be further from the truth. And I absolutely believe it. And I look forward one day to Alan Ryder being not quite so shy and coming on here and talking to us. I tell you what it reminds me of, the RSK story. The last big shake-up of the world, it wasn't a big shake-up, but the start of everything changing in the world of consulting engineers, where consulting engineers used to be offices full of almost exclusively gentlemen in and around Westminster, advising true. Government and so on, until there was a merger of Freeman Fox and Partners and John Taylor and Sons in, when was that? 1987, I think. And Freeman Fox were big into bridges. They'd designed the Forth Road Bridge, the Severn Bridge, both the Bosporus Bridges in Turkey. And they're a big name in bridge design. And John Taylor and Sons were the big name in water and sewers. And so these two giants of their sectors came together to form Acer Consultants, and they moved offices away from London to out of town away from Westminster to Guildford. And the man, I don't know if he was involved in bringing the two companies together, but certainly the figurehead of Acer at this time was a man called Eric Bridgen. But Eric Bridgen was cut from a different cloth from many of the old consulting engineer types. He was a businessman, out and out businessman. I think he worked for BP in the oil industry or something. Right. And there were even, I'm sure, because I was a junior reporter on New Civil Engineer magazine at this time, and I'm sure, I don't know if it was his competitors that referred to him this way, if there's some truth in it, but I think he was the man that was taught to as the former arms dealer, which, of course, you know, being an arms dealer is a perfectly legitimate business. Armies have to buy their cannons from somewhere. But it always sounds nicely pejorative, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
and I have an image in my head of a photo of Eric Bridgen smoking a big fat cigar. And Mr. Bridgen, if I'm thinking of the wrong man here, do forgive me. But he was seen to be somehow there's a slight distaste that suddenly money and capitalism had intruded on the world of consulting. And eventually they all did it. Atkins floated on the stock market and all this sort of stuff.
Of course, yeah.
Anyway, the story with Acer, with Freeman Fox and John Taylor, with these giant names that are going to go on and on and on forever. And then they went on this acquisition spree, and American investments came in and essentially, ultimately, they were taken over by Welsh Water, which was a publicly listed company, was it? Or was it American-owned at that stage? And then Welsh Water, it was called Huda, I think it's correctly pronounced. Huda. I always call it Huda, because it's H-Y-D-E-R.
Yeah, I always was.
if you speak Welsh, you call it Huda. Huda Consulting was eventually floated on the stock exchange. Lots and lots of acquisitions. Balloon. And in 2014, it was itself taken over by Arcadis. But my point, I think, is that particularly consultancies that acquire, it never seems sustainable. What's the end game? But then I suppose, you know, Pete Marwick, McClintock, McIntosh, McGillroy and Hoosier Mifflip, all these accountant firms come together to get bigger and bigger, and the law firms have all done it to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're still going. So,
but do you remember Hanson Trust? Hanson, of course, I associate with building materials, but I can remember an advertising campaign back in the early 80s, was it? Hanson was buying everything. I mean, it wasn't just building materials. It was known as the Hanson Trust, and this has just popped into my mind, so I haven't done any research into it. But they did television adverts saying, you know, we're big over here, and we're big in America, and we own this, we own that. I think they owned Smith and Wesson at one point.
They owned Grove Crane, and wasn't it?
They owned Grove Crane. Yes, that's right.
Wasn't it someone like Glenda Jackson who voiced the advert? It's some grand actor or actor. Actress, I think it's Glenn Jackson.
I can't remember who it was, but it was somebody quite prominent, certainly an actor or an actress of some note at the time. But again, it seemed, I suppose the thing with Hanson is that maybe it started to diversify. We talked about diversification away from your core activities in the past in relation to things like contracting and service supply and that kind of thing. But I think Hansen, its portfolio was so diverse that there was no structure to it, no real sort of coherence to it. Whereas I think of another company that has bought up lots of small businesses in the UK is a French company, Altrad.
Oh, yes.
You know, they've grown largely by acquisition, and they bought up companies which are almost exclusively in the scaffolding, formwork,
it started off temporary fencing. First business, I think, was making wheelbarrows or hod carriers.
Oh, really, was it?
Very humble beginnings.
I mean, I don't really hear much about Altrad. We used to hear a lot from one of their companies, Beaver 84, at one point.
Well, they've got their name plastered on the French football, rugby, certainly, and I think football as well, team.
Right, okay.
On the front of their shirts.
Uh-huh, okay, then, fine. Well, I wasn't aware of that. But, yeah, another company which seems to have grown by acquisition, and so far it seems to be doing okay. I mean, I think it's a much bigger concern in France than it is in the UK, but it's quite prominent. And it's quite a lot of quite well-known names, actually. I can only think of one at the moment, which is Cape Group, a scaffolding company which has been going for an awfully long time.
But you mentioned Hansen as you thought they owned Smith & Wesson. That was actually Greg Hutchins, so I'm now going to have to Google quickly. Tomkins, that was the name of his outfit. Greg Hutchins was Hansen trained, and he set up Tomkins. Similar deal, he was kind of like wasn't even a mini Hansen's, but he was the, I want to say tabloid, but I'm sure it was the Financial Times of the Times that coined this phrase. Guns to buns. He was a guns to buns tycoon because he owned Smith & Wesson and Hovis.
Good gracious.
Or who possibly even ranked Hovis McDougall as it was then, I'm not sure. To have your conglomerate going from guns to buns. Now, back on topic, RSK is much more properly focused. It's got a much clearer strategy. Yeah. It is not doing that. It's not asset stripping and I don't think that Alan Ryder is anything like as flamboyant as someone like Greg Hutchins was, who got a lot of criticism for putting many of his lifestyle costs on the business.
Right.
It was sort of his business, but it wasn't entirely his business. There were shareholders, and it was in that grey area between, you know, how much he's allowed to have his own way with it and to what extent the shareholders supposed to. Mm-hmm. And that all came tumbling down about 20 years ago now, I think. It was a sort of turn of the millennium type of story of that time.
And of course, another very acquisitive business, which you've written about on this topic many times before, is Terex. I mean, you pointed that out to me earlier in the week, that they grew rapidly and they bought up everybody. You mentioned Grove Cranes, where they ended up with
no,
Terex,
no, no. Grove Crane was bought by Hansen. Hansen at one point, which was interesting. But no, Manitowoc ended up buying
Manitowoc. That's the Call of Crane people.
No, yeah. Terex have bought. Blimey, now you got me started. I mean, the big acquisitions in Italy, they got, off the top of my head, D-Mag Mobile Cranes is the big ones. American Crane, mm-hmm. Crawler Crane in America. Commodale Tower Cranes in Italy, Pina Tower Cranes, PPM in France. What was in the olden days the MF, Massey Ferguson excavator stuff? Who is it? Benford Trucks, Power Screen.
That's right, lots of crushing and screening stuff.
What's the other outfit in Britain? I can't think. But Terex grew by acquiring, including the original Terex trucks business, which came out of General Motors up in Motherwell, yeah. I think it is.
That's right.
It grew. And it had to keep making these acquisitions in order to feed the beast, because none of the businesses it bought were particularly, in fact, a lot of them were loss-making, but none of them particularly profitable. And so Terex would move in, strip out cost, which as often as not meant jobs going, as often as not meant factories being closed, production being rationalised. Yeah. Their definition of waste was a lot more aggressive than your or my definition of waste would probably be. And in terms of it being a Wall Street investment, Terex was for a long time successful. But the shape of Terex today is very different. Yeah, they've sold off almost all of their crane bits, and they're not the same company that they were.
Do you think they did that in order to get out before everything came crashing down around their ears, or do you think they actually thought, well, you know, let's just try a different direction?
I think partly when the market turned, the 2008 crash, the 2009 crash, mm-hmm. Demand for construction machinery tanked. The threat from China. Terex were always excellent at the bottom end of the market. They had a slogan for their cranes: simple, available, and cost effective. I think there's a slogan.
Oh, that's right.
Which,
yeah,
and they would advertise their rough terrain cranes with a picture of a Grove rough terrain crane, a competitor rough terrain crane, usually Grove, alongside two of their own, and say, you know, basically, you can buy one of theirs or two of ours, which do you prefer? And this kind of like slagging off the competition advertising hadn't been seen before in the construction machinery sector. It was quite rare. And Terex were very gleefully gung-ho about, we'll shake them up, we'll show them what's what. You know, we're not going to be part of the old boy club kind of thing. And they got a lot of publicity on the back of that.
Yeah. So what's next?
Well, I'm torn. There's kind of three topics knocking around. I mean, traditionally, we've spoken about two things. Traditionally, our weekly podcast, David, we try and pick just three. We restrict ourselves to just three topics to talk about. Mm-hmm. So what do you want to talk about? Cladding, smart motorways, or steel?
Well, I don't know anything about the steel story, but we could talk about the smart motorways. Smart motorways, though, we've done quite a lot on.
We've done a lot on cladding too. Should we just whistle over the latest development in smart?
Yeah, let's do that. There have been quite a lot of rather hair-raising stories in the media about people who have been injured, killed, and suffered near misses while breaking down on one of these smart motorways because their distress has not been noted by the people monitoring the cameras in time. And I think there was a legal case, wasn't there, recently about a woman who was killed.
It was an inquest, but there've been periodic inquests because
that's
people
right,
getting
yes.
killed on them.
Yeah.
And
well, then the latest thing is apparently because the Highways England, the government actually, has conducted some sort of review. I think they couch it in a rather sort of, I think, rather Weasley
way. This stems back from that Panorama programme a year ago, which really sent Jack Russells down rabbit holes or ferrets down rabbit holes, and, mm-hmm. and people scurrying around going, "Ah, oh, we've been rumbled." And so Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, says, "I'll get back to you. I'll get my best people on the case, and we'll have a look at this, and we'll come right back to you."
Well, so they've done this review. I think they call it, a smart motorway safety evidence stock taken action plan, which is a bit of a mouthful.
That was a year ago. That was a thing a year
which
ago.
They published. Yeah, it was a year ago. They published that. Anyway, they've come out now and said that they've decided that they're not going to build any more smart motorways until they've sorted out the safety problems, which of course is a welcome announcement. But it's the closest they've come, as far as I can tell, to actually admitting that there is a problem.
Only some of the safety problems are they going to do. The thing is, there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with smart motorways per se. Smart refers to the whizzy wires,
if it works.
Wires and cameras and technology. No, but even if it doesn't work, even if the flashing lights saying reduce speed now don't come up, and even mm-hmm. if the speed cameras that are meant to take the picture of your number plate if you're driving over 70 or 77 or whatever they might set it to, even if they don't work, fine, no problem, smart motorways. Where they stop being smart is where they take away the hard shoulder. It's where it becomes all lane running. If you can have a smart motorway and have a hard shoulder, but they've chosen not to do that. They've chosen to take the hard shoulder and let live traffic run along it.
Well, I assume that's because the smart technology on its own isn't enough to alleviate the congestion. That they actually, there's no substitute for actually having a wider road for more traffic. You know, you can only get so much water through a hose pipe, however much you regulate it.
True, but a three lane dual motorway with variable message boards that can set and impose speed restrictions according to traffic flow, to optimise traffic flow, will have greater capacity than a dual three-lane motorway without that technology. Because the way the dynamics of congestion, the stop-startiness, you create the ripple effect, and that creates collisions, sudden braking and sudden acceleration is anathema to efficient movement of traffic, or inhibits the efficient movement of traffic, and it creates accidents or raises the risk of accidents. So the technology is fine. It's just the damn hard shoulders we want back, please.
So that's that. Tell us about steel, Phil. You've got a story about steel, which I'm completely ignorant of, so I'm all ears.
This is only a news story to me. This news story dates back to 2004. I only learnt this week that here in the UK, we make there's no steel mill that produces sheet steel piling. And I learnt this because I was sent a press release. I don't know whether it came from Port of Immingham or from the contractor Sheet Piling UK, but Sheet Piling UK and the owners of the Port of Immingham have done a deal where the port's going to stock and handle all their imported steel that comes in and work it and do whatever they do to it before sending it on to the sites where it's needed, as and when it's needed, as a sort of a logistics service. And I thought, that's an awful lot of steel. The port's going to stock at any one time have capacity to stock 16,000 tons of sheet steel piles. Now, I'm not very good at conceptualising how many double-decker buses or football pitches or whales are in 25,000 tons of steel pile. But it sounded like, 16,000 tons of steel pile, but it sounded like an awful lot. So I asked the whoever it was sent me the press release, said, that's in a lot that they're importing. Why? How much do they import and how much do they get from the UK? He said, well, actually, they import, you know, depending on the year, 25,000 tons of steel piles a year. And they do this because there is no UK steel producer that's prepared to make it. The last one I subsequently discovered by asking some questions, thinking, is this true? Chorus closed the heavy section mill in Scunthorpe in 2004, selling the assets of the sheet piling business to Arcelor of
Arcelor, yeah.
Arcelor is what I call it, but I never see it written down. Doesn't come up in many pub conversations. But they didn't sell the production facilities, so there's nothing. And at that time, Chorus had about 10 or 20% of the EU sheet piling market and three quarters of the UK sheet piling market. I don't think it's a shame after this, you know, Build Back Better, Brexit and everything, that we don't have the capacity to produce our own sheet steel piles. Do you know, the balance of trade of construction products and materials, building materials and components, is hugely negative. And the Construction Leadership Council has got a target of halving it between by 2025. And I think that's compared to the 2013 level was the benchmark. In 2013, the UK exported £6 billion worth of building materials, I got from data in front of me, and imported £12 billion. So we had a £6 billion a year trade deficit in the sector. The latest figures that I've got are for 2019. 2020 is going to be an odd old year all round, isn't it? But 2019.
Yeah, of course.
Exports increased from £6 billion to £7.7 billion. Good. But imports increased from £12 to £17.8 billion. So the balance of trade gap widened to £10 billion, £10.1 billion, which is not quite doubling, but hugely widened. So all the time we're meant to be, or there's a big government push on narrowing the balance of trade deficit in building products and materials, is still going in the wrong direction. But
yeah, exactly.
Where we do have a positive balance of trade, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, is sort of how it's presented as a positive,
is in production of construction machinery. If you look at the numbers produced by the Construction Equipment Manufacturers Associations of Europe, it shows that we export more machines than import by value.
Hmm.
The only thing is, I'm not sure how genuine, if you like, that is, because I'm sure a lot of the machines that are badged as being made in Britain, because if I want to put a CE mark on something in this country and declare myself the manufacturer, who the manufacturer is, I guess is what I'm saying, of any given machine or motor car mm-hmm. or vehicle is a moot point. If something comes down, if you know, Komatsu send over lots of kit components and these are put together in the UK and there you go, one UK made excavator, a lot of that value has been imported in the first place. And I'm sure JCB will probably import a lot of their components and materials, I guess. I have no knowledge of the details of that.
But, although probably, unlike Komatsu, I'm not trying to play off one against the other, but, you know, JCB's R&D design and all the rest of it is totally done over here, isn't it? Whereas presumably a Japanese manufacturer will presumably have designed and developed their designs in Japan.
Yes. No, I think that's right. Although where the design work takes place isn't a function of balance of trade deficit. I mean, that's
no.
But I wonder how British and how much British componentry and how much, you know, British added value is in each dollar of British machine that is being exported, because you could be damn sure that there'd be very little British dollar in every machine imported.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, there's a question which will have to be left hanging in the air, I fear.
Yeah, I can't answer that one, but it's an interesting one. But can we make more in this country, please?
Yeah, good idea.
I was going to talk about cladding, but if you're interested in the latest news of the cladding, which is the rather horrific news that Colmore Tang Construction, a contractor that's been pricing up jobs, has found that while the government thinks it's going to cost $5 billion to replace all the dangerous, unapproved, inappropriate, flammable cladding that's out there on our buildings over 11 metres, it ain't. It's going to cost something like £50 billion, not $5 billion. And even then, they actually really believe Colmore Tang is $100 billion, but they didn't think anyone would believe them. So they say, well, let's halve it for safety's sake, just for, you know, to round down and call it 50 billion. So that is, and there appears to be proper meat on their sums. So go have a look at that, people. Estimated.
Well, I'd love to know how the government came up with the figure of 5 million in that case.
5 billion.
I think they probably just sort of snatched it out of the air, didn't they?
No, I think they probably looked at how much do cladding panels cost.
Multiplied it.
How many cladding panels do we need to buy? Not realising, of course, as you mentioned the other day in your story about the hospital in Birmingham, was it? Where they have to completely strip back the whole building, get at the guts of it again.
Well, okay. Well, that's a topic for another day, I guess.
It's never going to go away, is it, that one? Right. Blimey, I've just looked at my watch. We've been talking a long time. Can we have some feedback? Podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. We'd like to have a letters section. We'd like to read out what you're saying. So tell us.
That'd be good.
Otherwise, thank you for listening. But for now, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.